Hi, I'm Simon Devereaux, Director of Global Talent Development at Framestore, and welcome back to the Framestore podcast and the second part of our double bill recruitment special with Framestore recruiters who support all eight of our global studios. You'll remember in part one on Monday, we kicked off with Mumbai, Melbourne and London. So today we visit the USA and Canada and meet with Kathleen Ruffalo, US Recruitment Manager, Julia Marone, Head of Recruitment Canada, and Margot Ingracia, Montreal-based recruiter. So here we go. Episode 42, part two of the Framestore podcast, our bumper recruitment special. Enjoy. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Framestore podcast, episode 42, part two. Every 2 weeks, as you know by now, we invite both a guest from our global Framestore community and a co-host with a keen interest in our guest role, craft or career path, and we let the magic happen. Although on this week's pod, we're continuing 2024's mix-up with another two-part special episode where we're switching our focus from internal support to external. We know that the pod has a decent non-Framestore subscriber base, so we thought in light of the current climate, post-pandemic and post-strike, plus the fact that there are a lot of folk either looking for opportunities or who simply need a steer career-wise, that we'd host a Framestore podcast double bill recruitment special. For part two today, we're chatting to our US and Canadian recruiters, having kicked off with Mumbai, Melbourne and London on Monday. So, as I said on part one, no dailies questions, mentor shout-outs, favourite meals or Spotify playlist suggestions. Just plain honest-to-goodness support, careers advice, pointers, best practice and top tips for anyone out there looking to break into the industry or have their eye on their next move, potentially joining the mighty Framestore. So let's do the intros. We have Kathleen Ruffalo, US Recruitment Manager, old friend of the podcast, based in Texas, who's been at Framestore since 2012, coming up via production and crewing, and now lead recruiter for all three of our studios in the US, namely New York, Chicago, and LA. We have Julia Marone, Head of Recruitment Canada, who has been with us since the fall of 2022, having spent most of her recruitment career with brands such as PwC, IBM, and other household names. Julia brings with her a wealth of experience in the recruitment game. And last but not least, we have Margot Ingracia, Montreal-based recruiter, has been with Framestore since 2012, having worked for The Focus previously and a range of other tech and IT recruitment roles. So there you go, our esteemed panel. We're here again. It's another podcast. We've got Kathleen on again in the same year. I mean, that's amazing. Obviously by popular demand, but we have some new blood on the pod in the form of Julia and Margot as well. So I'm excited to get into this. How are you all? Thank you for being on the pod, first and foremost, right? It's good to have you.
Thank you for having us. I hope everyone's not going to be sick of hearing from me, Simon.
No, well, you were a mere co-host on the last episode, so now you get to speak your truth, as they say. You're here as a bona fide guest to talk about your craft. And we're focusing on kind of the other side of the time zone today. As I said on Monday, we sorted London, Mumbai and Melbourne out, and now we're looking at the US and our Canadian studio. So I thought by way to kind of get us kicked off, my intros are very short and sweet on this podcast because I want to get into the conversation and the careers advice because we've only got about an hour to play with. But I'd love for you all to kind of briefly introduce yourselves and a bit more about your roles at Framestore. It's very easy for me to go, hey, we've got Margot and she's a recruiter, but you know, actually what kind of roles are you recruiting for? You know, what's the world like for you as recruiters? Perhaps we can start with Margot. You know, tell us a bit about you and your role at Framestore.
Yeah, first it's important to mention I'm Frenchy, so maybe my accent you will see that. I relocated to Montreal like a couple of years ago, and basically I remember during my third year in like high school, they asked us if we wanted to specialize either in a company or people management, and I knew right away that my way was people. So then I had a chance to start as a sourcer in an internship. I liked it, and I started in the IT industry, like you mentioned previously, and I met my partner at the same time, and he's a comp artist. Okay. So obviously, little by little, a lot of my friends were from the industry, and it sounded so fun. And so when I went to Montreal, there's so many studios, I was like, let's try, right? And The Focus gave me my chance, and then I joined Framestore 3 years ago, and I'm still really happy here, and I'm I mean, taking care of like viz dev, environment and GMP, lighting look dev, animation. So quite different from one to another, which is really cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
And what keeps you in recruitment? What is the big draw for you working? I mean, obviously you've got that kind of tech background and, you know, you said your other half was a compass, so you've kind of got the kind of visual effects DNA already, but what is it about your role that you you enjoy? What's the big draw for you as a recruiter?
Yeah. Like when I was saying my way was people, it's that definitely I could feel that I like just talking to people, trying to understand what they do, like their background. When I joined, the industry, I started to do some technical kind of, let's say, technical trainings about the departments because I was so interested in knowing a bit more, which is tricky because now I can be like, oh yeah, you're using this, and then the artist will think I'm technical and I'm not. But it's like, so then I'm like, no, not too much. But I really like to know people's background, where they came from, and just meeting new people every day. I feel like recruitment is really great for that. So
yeah, so bona fide interest in people, plus that kind of learning journey of supporting all of those technical roles, which you, like I say, you know, it's not like the full-blown encyclopedia, but you just start to learn a lot, don't you, as I imagine recruiting for those roles in terms of the type of work, the type of software that you're kind of trading in and that kind of thing. It's really interesting. Thank you for kicking us off, Margot. What about you, Kathleen? You've been with Framestore for a long time, and what keeps you here? What keeps you in this role? Because often recruiters tend to kind of, it's not always kind of like a stopgap for some people, but you know, some people go off to do other things, but then you have your hardcore of like really strong talent acquisition leads. You know, what is it that gets you out of bed in the morning, Kathleen, in your role?
The thing that I think I love about this position and, you know, being with Framestore and why I've stayed as long as I have, is very similar to what Margot is saying. It's about connecting with people, and it's never a boring day because you're always kind of engaging with different areas and hearing different people's backgrounds and understanding their passions and figuring out how it might be able to fit with what we're doing as a company here. So I think I've kind of found my space because I do really enjoy that kind of connecting the dots type of process with recruitment, of hearing what an individual really loves to do and what gets them to get out of bed every morning, and then listening to what our teams need and seeing how we can make those connections happen. And I get to recruit across such a wide range of positions. Since I am the only recruiter in the United States, I have to look after all of the departments and all the roles. So I kind of get to flex different ways of thinking in terms of, you know, people's skill sets and how they match with a different role. So that's something that I think I really enjoy as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask that because I remember you saying you were the only recruiter previously, and maybe I have some kind of like mental block where I've kind of erased it from my memory, because I was going to ask kind of what it is to be the lead recruiter for our US studios, which first we established at the start. There are three, but you are literally recruiting for the entire US arm of Framestore.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, in the United States, we are still smaller than just even like one of our offices in Canada, for example. So it's manageable, but I think it's, you know, because the United States is such a large territory, if you will, you really are kind of dealing with a wide range of points of view and perspectives and kind of slight nuances even between the three locations, even though we're all within the same country. So that, again, kind of keeps it interesting and, you know, engaging in terms of staying involved with all three offices.
Yeah, and I love what you said about there's never a boring day, because people are people, right? People have always got a story to tell. People are interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of working in the people game, is these different perspectives, different routes in. So yeah, same roles, but everybody's got a different perspective, right? So I love that. Thank you, Kathleen. How about you, Julia? So you're head of Recruitment Canada, best part of a couple of years with Framestore now. So you've got Vancouver and Montreal to look after. Can you kind of tell us a bit about how you operate? Because again, you've got a bit of a bigger group of recruiters under you, if that makes sense. How does it work?
Yeah, sure. So to your point, it just came to Framestore in 2022. So it's coming up on 2 years now, and I still feel very brand new. But for the most part, what we do is we definitely, a team of recruiters. We were 10 when I started, but just under that right now.
Yeah.
So recruiters really support the film side of the business, as well as support. And, our line of work is really very operational, very hands-on. Sometimes we don't get much notice. It's really project-driven. And so the recruiters are spending a lot of their days sort of sourcing, headhunting, making sure we're keeping those talent pools alive. And so we are managing the Montreal studio, which is a larger footprint than the Vancouver studio, which is a little bit newer, of course. We've been in Montreal for 10 years,
yeah.
Vancouver just short of a few years. And so that's what we do on a daily.
Cool.
But my style is more people-driven. I'm very much people-driven. And so I'm always interested in the people side of things. And so a lot of the times, you know, our team is really focused on that.
Of course. And how have you found your career journey? Because you came in via PwC, right? Is that, have I got that correct? Into the wacky, crazy world of visual effects. How's that been?
It's night and day.
Right.
So this was a choice of mine, having worked in many large, you know, as you mentioned, household names, corporate, big box names, whereby, you know, recruitment is done a very traditional way. You know, you really have a whole year to forecast and you have a whole year to sort of strategize and set yourself up for success. And you have a clearer sort of idea on what headcount and staffing looks like. It's not so much like that in the visual effects world.
Yeah.
You really only get like a 2 to 3 month window. And it's really project driven. And so from that perspective, it was a conscious and it was my choice to come into the creative world. As you mentioned, I'm a very people driven person. So for me, it was more about bringing your authentic self, your creative self to the world. And so that's why I really love this industry so much and was very curious to come into it. But I am a newcomer, so very, very new to it and learning so much. But it's so, so, so exciting. And I'm loving every moment of it. It's very ambivalent. I will say that it changes very much, but that also keeps me on my toes. So
good. And you are, you know, walking proof, I guess, of transferable skills. I mean, I always say on a lot of these similar podcasts is, you know, you can learn the craft, but you've got to have those kind of wonderful transferable skills, particularly in this game when it's about people. And you know what I'm saying, it's completely transferable. So really, really cool, really nice intros, thank you. So as I said at the start, we're not doing the traditional Framestore Dailies podcast questions, so we don't have a dramatic sound effect to drop from on high, so I'm just going to get into the questions. And I've split them out across general application advice through to networking, a conversation around trends, transferable skills, application process. Hopefully we'll have a bit of time to talk about EDI and then get some final thoughts. But I wanted to kind of ask you the first question, which is more about the overview of the current state of affairs in industry, because it is a bit of a choppy time for visual effects and animation. And I wanted to ask you, you know, what are some of the kind of trends you're seeing, recruitment trends you're seeing coming through, particularly in your parts of the world? Perhaps we can start with Kathleen.
Sure. I will be very candid, I suppose, and just say that it is a challenging time in the industry at the moment. And I think we'd all be a bit foolish to, you know, skirt around the fact that it is a difficult time. I think here in the United States, we're experiencing a lot of that just due to some of the delays and schedules with the further impacts of the strikes. And a lot of the work that we were doing more in episodic has kind of been pushed. And so we're still kind of waiting for those schedules to pick up, which obviously those teams are larger and usually require us to do more recruitment. And we haven't really had to do that since we're able to manage the kind of workload with the team that we have already in our various US offices. So there's not a ton of opportunities that I've seen opening up. I think speaking from our perspective at Framestore, we've had a few sporadic roles that we've had the opportunity to fill over, you know, the course of the last 6 months or so, definitely on a much lower range than I would say we typically have experienced my tenure with Framestore. And also I think we're definitely hiring far less freelancers or kind of short-term coverage the way that we've had to in the past, again, because partly we've been able to work more collaboratively across the sites over the last few years, you know, since we're all a little bit more remote, and that ability to work in this, you know, remote capacity has opened up the opportunity for us to rely on our artists from other offices. So it's not as imperative that you find LA-based artists work on an LA project, New York for New York, et cetera. So in that sense, it's definitely slower. I think I've also just been noticing generally in the the US landscape that there aren't a ton of studios hiring just in general. When there are open opportunities, it's usually for more senior experienced individuals. Those junior roles seem to be fewer and further between. But on the plus side, we are still doing the internship.
Yes, of course.
I am noticing other studios offering their internship programs this year. So I do think there is still growth and there is still going to be opportunities. I think it is a bit of a lull at the moment. But as you know, I think I'm sure other people have said, this is cyclical. You know, it comes and goes. I do think it's temporary. I do think there is a shift happening a little bit in the industry, but you know, I still think there will be need for further growth and us hiring more aggressively. But I think the other thing I'll say before I stop talking too much is I think the remote work has really opened a lot of doors for more talent to get into the industry, which I think used to not be as easy to break into because you needed to be local to specific cities and states or regions, et cetera. So I think, again, that's made it a bit more competitive, but also it's made it obviously a lot more flexible. So people can make some choices about lifestyle that they prefer in terms of where they live, and they're not forced to live in these very high cost of living areas. Mm-hmm. But on the same hand, I would encourage anyone that's kind of at the beginning of their career to still think about being local and at least hybrid with the studios that they're applying to, because there's so much you gain from having at least some of that in studio time. So that's kind of like a trend that I think I've noticed over the last few years is this kind of flexibility that's opened up the talent pool, which, you know, is a plus and a minus, I think you could say.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Kathleen. And I do have a question about, it's a wonderful segue into a question I've got around remote working, which I'll get to. But I'd love to hear from Julia and Margot about the some of the trends you're seeing in Canada, particularly Montreal and Vancouver. Maybe, Julia, could you take this one in terms of the helicopter over both, and then Margot could follow up.
Yeah, sure. So similar to what Kathleen said, there's a lot going on in the industry right now that is somewhat out of our control on the client side of things, sometimes the government side of things, especially recently in Quebec. And then, you know, the strikes that have happened as well and the impacts of that across the industry. So we're just kind of sort of recovering from that. And that has shown its head amongst our candidates who are finding themselves out of work. I mean, we're in a situation where, you know, even in Quebec, more than half of the population of VFX workers are basically unemployed as a result of the studios that did not survive all of this turbulence. And so, for Framestore, what that means is, I mean, we've come out strong, which is great and a testament to what we do and how we are seen by our clients. But what we're seeing this year, the trend is mostly looking for mostly animation, CFX artists. And it's really, you know, short-term contracts, 6 to 7 months, very quick, you know, for the turnover on projects that that need to be delivered. So that's really what we're seeing this year. But again, from a volume perspective, I mean, we're not seeing such high volumes from recruitment that I've been told we've had historically. Mm. But I think, again, that's a testament to the market.
Absolutely.
So that's really what's been going on for us. I don't know if Margot, you want anything to add there?
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I agree with you both with what's happening, but I feel like I have hope, definitely, because I can see that we are on the right kind of road of, like, you know, having new roles in the next year, let's say, or so, like starting in the summer. Like, I can see that other studios are hiring right now, which is good. So it's usually animation because it's just the beginning of the process and everyone is just starting to work on projects. So it's mainly animation or CFX, that type of departments. But I do have hope. I feel like we are on the end of, like, you know, the fact that was a really challenging year, and the year to come will be better.
Yeah. So keep the faith, keep in contact, keep communicating. I want to talk a bit about transferable skills and career pivoting in a minute, but I do want to come back to what Kathleen mentioned around remote working. And one of the questions I've got is the idea that remote working is obviously becoming more prevalent for obvious reasons. I'd love to hear more about how it's impacted the recruitment process within Framestore. And perhaps could you offer some advice for candidates navigating those opportunities that either are out there or potentially will appear further down the pipe?
Sure. So in the US and within advertising, so just to clarify for people, in Framestore's US offices, our focus is primarily split between our advertising content as well as episodic and some immersive as well. Mm-hmm. Within advertising, there's a lot of flexibility on where work can take place. We're not tied to any particular incentives that might be offered by particular cities or states. So remote work really has opened up the opportunity for people to explore living in various parts of the country and continuing to work on similar types of projects. The thing that I think we all recognize the benefit of is, as I was saying, you're not forced to live in these very high cost of living kind of central hubs that, you know, the entertainment industry usually exists within. So Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and people have been able to kind of explore living in more affordable areas. And I think there's a lot of positives to that. And even if you do stay in locations like our, where our studios are based, you're not having to commute in every day and deal with that kind of extra 2 hours on your work day, getting back and forth to the office. And I think there's also a lot to be said to the benefit of concentration sometimes for those that, you know, can get easily distracted in an office environment. You know, people come up, ask them questions, interrupt their flow. So I think it's kind of nice to have a bit of both. I know that I can be far more productive at home and in my remote space because no one interrupts my day. But also I still really miss people interrupting my day wish I had somebody asking me, you know, a random question while I'm in the middle of watching, you know, 50 reels back to back. So I think in that regard, that's really allowed that remote work to be a benefit. I think there's a lot of pros to allowing that flexibility. With the episodic content that we work on, which, and also with features, I'm sure everyone else can elaborate on that further. There are often tax incentives that are tied to that work and where it needs to happen. So we are far less flexible in terms of being able to allow candidates and, you know, employees to live anywhere. They do need to be based in these particular areas. And that's a lot of why I don't think you see a ton of feature film work happening in the United States, because there aren't as competitive of, you know, subsidies offered by our, you know, states and cities that are offered elsewhere in the world. So I think that obviously has limited some of the work that happens in the US. I think the ability to work remotely has allowed, again, for people to kind of spread out and for us to also get connected to talent that we, again, aren't limited to them being in a commutable distance to our offices. But there's still so much value, I think, in coming into a studio and working, you know, next to people and being able to learn from them and just listening to what's going on in the space around you and all the skills that you kind of gain just from being in a space with others. So, you know, hopefully that hybrid model is something that can continue to evolve. I think, again, I still, obviously as a remote worker myself, I'm never going to talk about it not being a good thing and something that shouldn't be available to people. But, you know, if I had my way, I would be hybrid if, you know, life allowed. But yeah, that I think is my feelings on the topic.
We might open a facility in Texas. That would be cool.
Yeah, wouldn't it? They should think about it. Definitely. The VES is trying to, you know, make a chapter here and encourage companies to do more in Texas. So we'll see.
Excellent. Not off the table. I love it. How about the situation in Montreal and Vancouver? You know, what's the, well, you know, what advice would you give people considering those remote opportunities? Are there, were there, will there be remote opportunities, or are more and more people coming back to studios?
Yeah, I think as it relates to remote opportunities, we are working right now on a hybrid model. So we definitely try to encourage people coming into the studio simply because, I mean, not to say you can't work, you know, remotely. Mm-hmm. There are definitely lots of advantages. I mean, listen, I'm a mom and I've got kids, and for whatever reason or anyone's reasons, flexibility is great. And that's the advantage of working remotely. But especially in this environment, what we're trying to do is bring back people in person because there's a synergy, there's an energy, especially when you bring a bunch of artists together in a Viz room and you just kind of work together. There's nothing like doing that, you know, in person. There is an energy in the studio, and we have cool studios. I mean, we have cool places to work. They're not boring. They're not, you know, so we do encourage it. We're on a hybrid, you know, model right now, whereby we ask them to come in at least 2 days a week, one, you know, project day, one team day, and then the rest of the time can be remote. Yeah. We also encourage, you know, we do crew globally, so we encourage relocations. We do have some tax restrictions that won't allow us to have people working, you know, out of the province that they're supporting. So there's that. And but we, you know, we pay for the relocation. So if anyone's willing to move here from another country, that'd be fantastic. We encourage that. But yeah, we are on a hybrid model.
Cool. Excellent. Brilliant, brilliant. Well, I'm going to ask the next question to Margot, and then we'll kind of go in reverse order, because I want to talk about transferable skills. And it's one of the areas we didn't get to cover on our first part of the episode, just because of time and, you know, so many questions, not enough time. And the idea of career pivoting and transferable skills. And the question is, you know, for people out there transitioning from other industries, you know, into visual effects and animation, what advice do you have for them tailoring their CVs, resumes, even kind of potential reels if they're looking for artistic roles? Or, you know, advice for them highlighting their transferable skills to appeal to recruiters, people like your good selves? You know, what's your thoughts around that, Margot?
I feel like there's two type of skills first. So the soft skills for sure that everyone has in every kind of job we can do. And I'd say for, I know that there was like, you know, another kind of point about that, about like the main kind of, you know, soft skills we're looking for in the industry, that would be like communication type of skills, because of course in the industry it's all about teamwork, all about, you know, all of us working together to create, you know, magic and movies and everything. And so we need someone who will be able to communicate pretty well, to have this kind of team spirit. Also the fact that you're going to work with people, you're going to need to, you know, do a lot of problem solving, so you need to be clear. And that's the thing you can definitely have from a past experience for sure. And about all the kind of art skills, which is more technical, you can always, when I think about either people, I know there's a lot of people transitioning from an entire different industry, but there's also people going from coming from design or coming from production, and, you know, they want to be an artist. So you can always, you know, have an idea of some softwares you worked on. And it's good to just also train on the side yourself on, you know, softwares, you know, that are really valuable in the industry. So that would be, for example, Maya, or that will be ShotGrid, for example. But I feel like we have a lot of people coming from video games, which sounds a bit different, but it's actually kind of the same process in some ways. So there's a lot of process where kind of the same between, let's say, video game, feature animation, and VFX, so it's definitely easier. But from someone who are like me, I started, you know, in the IT, so I had to learn a lot. And it's more about being like curious, you know, take time to, when you join, I don't know, talk to, you know, people, ask questions, reach out to people on LinkedIn, like develop a network around VFX. If you want to join the VFX world, for example, just to know a bit more about the main kind of studios, what they do. Asking to, you know, people communicate again is a good way to know. But yeah, there's definitely skills you can transfer from past experience.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'm hearing more and more about people getting into industry via probably a more obvious one, as you say, Margot, is kind of like the gaming industry in terms of software. But then you kind of got architecture, engineering, you know, because obviously there's so many more kind of tech levels to working in our industry as well. It's not like the old days. I remember working at the mill. It was, you worked in 2D, 3D or production, and that was kind of it. And now there's so many, many levels. I mean, Kathleen, from your perspective, you know, you've got people out there who are considering moves into of the visual effects industry. Do they need to be more proactive than just relying on those comparable skills? So there's an architect has obvious kind of maybe environments kind of skills, right? But, you know, what do they need to be doing more to kind of add extra flavor to that, to get noticed by a recruiter? You know, do they need to be more proactive? Do they need to be learning a software as Margot recommended?
I think right now they do need to be very proactive, honestly. Yeah. The competition is steep at the moment, because there are so many people on the job market currently and a lot of very talented individuals. So I think those that are trying to make the shift over would really need to take that extra effort to showcase how the work that they've done in their field really is transferable. Because although we definitely have worked with people like architects that have kind of made that change over, they still need to present, you know, a portfolio of work that seems relatable to the work that we're doing. Again, in these circumstances where there's 100 applicants for one job position, we will kind of have to evaluate, as much as we do try to be open-minded to different perspectives and different skill sets that can benefit and perhaps offer a new way of thinking and how we can work more effectively and efficiently. We do still need to see them display that they can do the fundamentals of whatever the role is that they're applying for. So if they're working in a completely different type of software, although it's easy to kind of make the connections that, like, sure, they could probably transfer it's going to be even easier if they showcase that they've taken some initiative to get to know Maya or Houdini or, you know, Nuke or whatever it is that they're meant to be working within. So I definitely don't think now is the time to kind of rest on, oh, but I have this illustrious career in this other industry. It's like you do have to do a little bit of the extra effort.
Yeah, you can't just waltz in through the front doors and go, I'm an architect. I have a 20 years study under my belt. But yeah, absolutely. Great advice. And I think proactivity is coming up a lot. I mean, I'm running these podcasts. I'm running the Access VFX one as well at the moment. And there's this sense of kind of when you connect with a recruiter, don't just connect out of the blue. Don't just go, hey, I'm here. Have you got any jobs? And the same with kind of the with transferable skills. It's about having a reason to do it, whether it be connecting with a recruiter or considering a move into industry. You've got to go that extra mile, right? You've got to, you know, add that extra seasoning to whatever it is you're doing. So I'm using kind of culinary. I'm missing the favorite meal question, so I'm adding culinary metaphor to my rhetoric. Julia, do you agree with what's been said so far? You know, the whole idea that you have to go that extra mile, you have to kind of at least show willing to kind of flex your visual effects animation skills when you do have some inbuilt transferable prowess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I agree with everyone's points, especially as it relates to maybe changing careers. Or I mean, I'm a firm believer that no one really has one straight career path or one straight narrow path. You know, we're constantly evolving as people. We're constantly just figuring out our purpose, and you know, it could change from year to year and or even day to day. And so in recruitment, you know, I think it's really important to look at those transferable skills and convince our hiring leaders that, you know, maybe this is not the traditional resume that you're wanting to see with the traditional experience, but really trying to figure out what are those transferable skills. But for the candidates out there, because there are so many that are out of work right now, I would say, you know, to everyone's point, just be curious, but see what you can do to stand out. Take a look at the job description, find at least one point that speaks to you that you can maybe talk to in terms of transferable skills. A lot of the times it's just soft skills. And then whatever's missing, upskill yourself. Be curious, go out there in the market and just network. Talk to people who are doing what you want to do and then just sort of connect with them. I mean, the beginning of my career, I did a lot of that. And let me tell you, I'm still doing that. And I don't think you should ever stop doing that. You know, there's just sky's the limit in terms of curiosity.
Love that. Well, I'm going to take that and I'm going to create another segue because I'm always about the segues. If I capture a segue, and you've mentioned networking, I've got a whole question about networking. I'm just going to throw at you, Julia, right? So I'm going to stay with you in the top right corner of my grid. And I'm going to ask about the importance of networking within our visual effects community. But the question is, what are some effective ways for aspiring VFX professionals to expand their network? How would they go about it?
Well, there's a number of, you know, associations and events that go on throughout the year that are really related to visual effects and societies within visual effects. You know, just here at Framestore, we have a number of things that, you know, we have career events, global career events, local career events. We've got our FMX, we've got our Annecy. Those are the global ones. We've got, or the European ones rather, you know, we're talking Canada related. I mean, we have 20 plus school events that happen throughout the year or just events in general where, you know, most of them are free. And if not, or we have guest speakers where you can sit there. There's Q&A. And so there's many, many opportunities. You just have to find those. I mean, we're happy to share them, of course, if anyone wants to message us. But you just need to be part of them and know when they're happening. But there's a ton of them that happen throughout the year. And those are opportunities for you to be there, be present, ask questions, stay informed, know what's going on in the industry, know, you know, the difference between the different studios, which one plays more to your values, to what you're looking for. And so those are really the opportunities to get involved. So I would recommend that for sure in terms of networking.
Okay, brilliant. So they speak, I think, to the absolutely those more traditional connecting events, those in-person events, which are opening up a lot more now. But perhaps for people out there who are probably more introverted, probably don't feel comfortable going to an event where they have to kind of, you know, shake hands and kind of interrupt people mid-conversation. Margot, what would be your advice for introverts to maybe connect and network in a more digital space, whether it be through social media or any other medium? What would be your advice, Margot?
Yeah, that sounds super an easy one, but like LinkedIn for sure. I mean, that's the way to go at first, at least. Follow the studios you're interested in just to see their kind of, you know, what's happening, you know, and following kind of, you know, the news that's happening for them. And also, yeah, I feel like I had so many people from the industry when I started, either, you know, support type of people. So that would be recruiter like me, but also artists.
Yeah.
And just kindly, you know, you can always be like, hey, I'd just like to connect, you know, and then if they reply, maybe you can ask them questions about, you know, their role, you know, their feedback about the company. That's super important as well. So I feel like LinkedIn, of course, is like the way to go for that.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, just try and if you're, of course, part of a school, that's also easier because you will have other people. But just, yeah, connect with artists, connect with people, connect with also recruiter because, you know, maybe you're not looking right now. Maybe you will in 6 months. So it's always good to have some people and always think about, yeah, communication. And it's that's
yeah.
easier, you know, if you reach out over a message than real life, that could be easier. So, yeah.
Great. No, I love that. And I dread to think how many approaches you must all get on LinkedIn. I mean, I get a lot and I'm not a recruiter, right? And it's hard to keep on top of it because LinkedIn's a social network, but we kind of treat it like an email, like an inbox now, don't we? Yes, it's kind of like, it's gone a bit Facebook, people putting their birthdays on there and stuff, but ultimately it's kind of where it's at when it comes to online recruitment. So Kathleen, how do people stand out when they're approaching you on LinkedIn, when they're asking you about opportunities, you know, because it's not as simple as just going, hi, Kathleen, thanks for connecting. Have you got any jobs going? I don't think that's going to work, right? That's not going to float. You know, how do people build that network meaningfully?
Yeah. I mean, my advice is to try to make your outreach as personal as you possibly can. So take a little bit of extra time and effort to do a little research about the people you're reaching out to. So if you can find them somewhere else online in terms of some of the projects they may have been a part of and mention that when you reach out to them, like, oh, I really loved this, you know, Pepsi spot that you did 5 years ago and really
right.
curious how you all achieved what you did, or I loved your work on Guardians of the Galaxy 3, you know, tell me more about how you made Rocket come to life, whatever it is that it might be. But do the extra effort, you know, understand what their, you know, experience might be and make that connection a bit more personal and have a point to what your communication is. You know, messaging a recruiter like, hey, do you have any jobs, is like the most meaningless message to ever get, of like, well, sure, what, but what kind, or
yeah.
what are you interested in? Or did you even look at our careers page to see that we had these roles open, or which kind of role are you interested in? So, you know, actually making the message have meaning, because I think, you know, like you said, I get lots of messages, many that are just, you know, thanks for connecting, et cetera, which is great, but I usually won't respond to those. I get a lot of messages that sometimes are like, can I ask you a question? And I just want to like scream, just ask the question.
Maybe start with the question. Yeah.
Don't ask me if you could ask a question, just ask me the question. So, you know, going into it with, you know, what is your motivation of making this connection with this individual? Obviously, I get reaching out to a recruiter, your goal might be to get a job, but you need to think a little bit deeper than that as to what kind of role you're trying to get. You acknowledge that you maybe did some research, saw that they don't have a position that's relevant to your skill set right now, but that you'd still like to make this connection because of XYZ. Maybe there'll be an opportunity in the future. So making the messages actually connect to the individual, I think will have a far bigger impact. You know, I've said this a few times to people very recently. I think you're better off spending your time writing 5 meaningful outreach messages than doing 100 in a day and just having them be this kind of generic template that you send out to every single person, because we'll be able to tell. I mean, it's pretty obvious when it's just a generic like template thing that you've written, whereas if you take the time to like look into the individual's background and what they're working on currently, you know, you can make it a bit more relatable and you are far more likely to get a response, because the person will feel like, oh, they actually want to know me and what I have to offer and not just trying to utilize me to get a job.
Yeah. Yeah, really good advice. Thank you. And on that, we're in the kind of this LinkedIn kind of sphere. I did a little bit of prep. I do prep these podcasts, I promise. I don't just wing them as people think out there, the haters. But I wanted to share, have a conversation about, we have kind of like Framestore podcast bingo at the moment, because I always seem to mention Amy Smith on every episode. But I did speak to Amy Smith about this episode and said, look, these are the questions I'm considering. Have I missed anything? And she threw in a couple of really interesting ones that I'm just going to throw out there. They're really short, but really cool. And the first one is CV versus LinkedIn. Are they two disparate things? Is there a blend? Is there a preference? Do people still write CVs and send CVs? I don't know. I'm asking the question. What are your thoughts, Julia?
Oh, that's a good question. We're on LinkedIn a lot. So, I mean, for us, our default, our go-to, especially since we're on there headhunting and that sort of thing as well, sometimes our default is to just go to the LinkedIn profile. But oftentimes there's not a lot of content there. So, you know, we do appreciate the CVs. And what I love about this industry is, and what is still a culture shock for me, is the look and feel of these CVs. They're so beautiful and artistic. And some of them are like, it's art in and of itself. And you can get away with that in this industry. And we welcome that because it sort of speaks to everyone's creativity and uniqueness. And that is what stands out in this industry, is your uniqueness. Whereas in other industries, it's more like, how can you conform and just be like everyone else, right? And so I think that it's kind of both. Sometimes, you know, a CV tells a story and we appreciate that. And sometimes we don't have a CV, we'll go to LinkedIn. But I don't know, I'm really on the fence about that.
Yeah.
The advantage is we see someone's profile on LinkedIn, we can message them right away. And it's quicker. That's the one pro, but I'm on the fence for that. There's pros and cons to both.
It's definitely not one or the other, isn't it? I mean, we asked the same question on part one, and we had a really interesting conversation. I think it was Nikunj in Mumbai was talking about getting CVs that were like 10 pages long. I'm like, really? Do people still write length where they just don't leave anything out? I mean, do you receive CVs that are literally mini kind of novellas?
No, not at all. I feel like it's like, you know, mostly one page, and then sometimes you will, you know, get a long one. But I feel like it's definitely printed CVs we need to stop. Like, I feel like I can say that out loud, you know, when
say
you
it.
To an event and we go back with like 20 CVs, like we could, you know, just send that online. And that's what LinkedIn is actually really cool for, is because if we go to an event, we just have to QR code kind of our LinkedIn profile, just go on it. But then, you know, you will be able to send your resume. But I feel like printed CV, please don't. It's like,
stop it, everyone. You heard it here on the podcast. Like, stop giving out CVs at events. My God, they didn't get read. They gather dust in your drawer, right? So that's Margot's take. Thank you. Great answer. What about you, Kathleen? Do you have a view either way, or are you on the fence like Julia?
I think you need both, honestly. You know, I think having a presence on LinkedIn is very valuable in our industry because we're actively on there. So, you know, skipping that would be just blocking yourself from a lot of opportunities. But I still think when you're applying to a position that you should submit a formalized CV and not just a PDF of your LinkedIn profile, because it just shows that you've, again, kind of taken some effort. If you're, you know, headhunting like we do sometimes, I will just kind of import what I can find on your LinkedIn. But, you know, if you're the one looking for the job opportunity, I still think you need to have the formal CV.
So speaking of formal then, and we can stay with you on this, Kathleen, is the next Amy Smith conundrum is a cover letter or not to cover letter.
I'm passionate about this.
Yeah, you like a cover letter?
It's a good one.
Let's hear it. Let's dig into that passion.
I love cover letters. Write me a cover letter, please, and thank you. It doesn't need to be long, but any job posting that I make for the US where I require a cover letter, if the people do not actually submit a cover letter, I immediately reject them.
Okay.
Immediately.
Whoa.
I won't even look at anything else. Because I think that's just showing that you think you're better than the application process if you're not willing to submit even just a few sentences. But I think the cover letter is a really valuable tool to showcase your personality. I think a lot of people get overwhelmed by the idea of a cover letter because they think they need to write multiple paragraphs and like a very detailed explanation of who they are and their mantra about professional life. But it's just, you know, a few words is absolutely suitable, but it's just an opportunity for us to get to know who you are a little bit better. better to see how you communicate, because you're going to be doing a lot of written communication in probably every single position you would have within the visual effects industry in one form or another. So being able to see that you can put together a clear sentence is something really valuable. And that's why I like the tool of using a cover letter. I think it's important, again, to not just write a super generic cover letter that you just use all the time for everybody. You do have to make the effort to make it more personal. But we've definitely given candidates, you know, a second look or further consideration because of what they've written in their cover letter. Because also kind of relating to that transferable skills scenario, or if you're trying to make a shift into a new industry, the cover letter is where you explain what you've done elsewhere and how it can be applicable to what you're trying to do now in this role that you're applying for. So big fan, love the cover letter.
Yeah, I guess you can fill in lots of gaps, can't you? Because ultimately a LinkedIn profile slash CV is just a linear story of years and dates and jobs. Mm-hmm. Whereas I imagine a cover letter can kind of be a, have a bit more narrative attached to it, a bit more reasoning, like meaning, as you mentioned earlier. That's really, really interesting. I'm loving the absolutes on this podcast. I'm loving Margot and Event going, keep those CVs away from me. And Kathleen going, yes, cover letter for sure, or you're getting rejected. I love it. It's brilliant, brilliant stuff. Podcast fodder. But on the detail piece, right, on the cover letter narrative, and I'm going to ask the same questions to all of you. Don't worry, I'm going to come to you, Julia and Margot, but I want to stay with Kathleen on this one, is can you spot a ChatGPT'd cover letter?
I think I could. I mean, I could maybe be fooled, but it's usually pretty obvious if it's, you know, a pretty generic kind of message, or if it's so connected to the job description in a way that it's just like, obviously they put in the prompt of write a cover letter for this job. Yeah. I'm not opposed to utilizing ChatGPT as a tool to help you, you know, edit your writing or help you rethink phrasing of something. But I think when you rely on it to do everything for you, it's, you know, not working to your advantage.
Brilliant. Thank you, Kathleen. So I'm going to jump on my little mode of transport and go to Canada now and ask the same question. Julia, what are your thoughts on the cover letter, to be or not to be?
I mean, I won't completely disqualify someone if they don't have a cover letter, although I totally respect Kathleen's point of view here. I really think that, to me, if there's a cover letter, if there isn't one, it doesn't make a difference. Unless, you know, I will refer to a cover letter if it's really not clear what you want to do. So if, for example, you know, you have 20 years experience and it's really varied your experience, you've done many different things, then I'm not quite sure what you want to do here or what your intentions are. So then I might refer to the cover letter. So I would say in that context, it's really important to have it. And also it's, again, an opportunity to express yourself and tell the story of your experience where you might not be able to see that when you look at the experience. And to the ChatGPT question, I would say I might get fooled because I'm still not 100% well-versed in all the fancy terminologies and VFX. So they may play to my flaws there. Mm. But I am a firm believer that if you do, you know, try to cheat your way into things, it'll come up somehow.
It's going to bite you.
And that's going to be in the interview process, or you're just shooting yourself in the foot for if and when you get hired. I mean, really. So, yeah.
Yeah. Karma's going to get you, right?
Yep.
I like it. What about you, Margot? Similar views, or do you have a different take on both questions, the cover letters piece and the ChatGPT radar that you may or may not have?
Yeah, I'm more on Julia's side in a way, because I'm not going to, same cover letter. I don't really take a look at it like all the times, let's say. But we do have, when you apply at least to Framestor, we do have a cover letter kind of point when they need to, write something. So I will check about this one. But I'm always, when we do the first kind of, pre-screen with the candidate, I will always ask why Framestor, which is kind of my cover letter. Because at this point, I can see they're just like, well, you're doing VFX, or, oh, well, you worked on, Harry Potter, a couple of years ago, and I was a fan of the thing you did. So I can see the difference. But I understand also Kathleen's point being if they want to explain, and I could do it without, I could, continue the process without it. But for ChatGPT, I feel like if you do the effort of writing one, don't use ChatGPT, because just don't write it or write it properly. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this, that could help you for rephrasing and everything. But I feel like if you, take the effort to do it. You should do it by yourself and try to be inspired. But that's tricky. I have to say I did a huge mistake on mine. By the way, I just wanted to say that as a joke also, but I did when I applied to Framestore, I put Rodeo in the cover letter. So that was really a shame of me. So that could be, that's tricky for me, the cover letter, because, you know, sometimes just if you apply to different places, that's a lot, you know, to do. So anyway, I was, you know, hired, but I mean, you need to be careful of that as well, just to make sure that you do something personal with the company for sure. But yeah, that's the tricky subject. I feel like my heart is like in both kind of, yeah.
Yeah, you're flexible. That's fine. Interesting, though, I was just come off another podcast recording where we were talking about the same subject, and one of our guests said they quite enjoy reading cover letters that have at least one spelling mistake in, just so you know a human being's written it. Whereas back in the day, you'd be like, oh my, look at that, terrible. No, we're not going to take them on because of the spelling mistake. Now it's like, actually, it's a human being. Thank you. At least you made an effort. But great answers. Thank you. Thank you all for leaning into that. I want to kind of move, and I'm going to come back to the behavioral human skills shortly, but I would love to kind of segue into the artistic, technical, and creative piece and talk a bit about portfolios and reels. And for those aspiring artists out there, or artists and technical artists out there who are currently in between roles, could you share some top tips for crafting a standout portfolio or showreel that catches the attention of a Framestore recruiter? You know, what are some best practices that exist? Perhaps we can kick off with Kathleen.
Sure. I always encourage people to build a reel or a portfolio that showcases a strong kind of photorealism in terms of the artistic work that they're creating. Yeah. Because that is the majority of the content that we're producing at Framestore kind of matches that aesthetic. So definitely to keep that in mind when they're applying to us, because that's what we're usually looking for. I always also encourage versatility in the kind of content that they're showing. So for us, again, in the United States, since we're working on predominantly advertising content, the requests from our clients are going to vary drastically, you know, and so we're always going from one project to the next rather rapidly. So, you know, one day we might be working on a spot that's very hard surface focused in terms of the assets created we're creating versus a project that might be more about like making a photoreal owl or gecko, if you will, like we do. So showcasing that you can kind of move between different looks or, you know, tasks, I think is really helpful. And that's what I mean when I say versatility, is kind of showcasing mm-hmm. a bit of variety in the type of work that you can do. Not that we're necessarily only looking for generalists, although we're far more open-minded to generalists in the advertising side of the business. It's just that kind of ability to shift between the different types of requests that might come through our clients, and that ability to adapt is something that if you can showcase that in your portfolio, it'll definitely help you stand out. I think focusing on just showcasing your best work. I always say I'd rather your reel be under a minute long and just highlighting your absolute best pieces than building something out that's over 2 minutes that's got some mediocre work, because it's far more likely that we will dismiss somebody's portfolio if there is a piece that is much weaker than the others, because that'll just kind of make everyone question your ability to edit, your ability to kind of analyze your own work and say, maybe this piece isn't as strong and still needs some more work. So really just kind of focusing on the best that you've done is more important.
Yeah, that comes up a lot actually, is kind of don't just put all your work in, you know, and particularly with not necessarily attention spans, just the brevity of reels that you must look at. You need to kind of get your attention, I imagine, right? Yeah. So,
and I think most hiring managers and most recruiters can evaluate a reel in 20 seconds and know that if they want to keep watching it or not, you know. So it really, it's your best work first is really important, especially when we're dealing with volumes of, you know, over 100 applications for one position.
That's a lot. And from a real, thank you, Kathleen, a really great answer. And Margot, if I could take that a step further around the balance between kind of finished work and breakdown type work. I mean, what is a good balance for a short reel? Do you kick off with the super polished stuff, or do you get into the real nitty gritty kind of how they got there? I mean, it must be a minefield to navigate as an applicant, right, in terms of getting that edit correct. But what's your view on that?
Yeah, I feel like a breakdown demo is really the way to go. Like, to it's interesting to know, you know, how you get there. So let's say if you did, you know, like a whole modeling, like what was references and how you did, you know, the entire kind of way. But I agree with Kathleen. It's tricky also because we want it to be short and sweet, right? The demo, like 2 minutes max. So you need to find this balance, like you were saying. But I feel like it's better to see like two pieces, but like the entire type of, you know, way and process that you did, than just a lot of different things without understanding what you've done. Like, it's really important for us, especially in the industry, we're all working together. So it's like a team job. So really to understand what you've done exactly, like sometimes many people, not many, but like sometimes many actually, but sometimes at least 2-3 people will work on the same shot. So it's interesting to know exactly what you've done.
Yeah.
And I feel like a breakdown could really help. But also I suggest with the demo, you can also do a breakdown document, which will exactly explain what you've done. I know that I was talking to one of our animation supervisor who joined, and he was like, I don't understand why all artists should have a breakdown demo, all level, you know, they should all have this. Yeah. So it's like the document that can explain, okay, shot one, this is what I did. This is like the tools I used. So you have a, you know, like a space where you could just detail and
That's great. I was going to ask, how do you articulate that? Do you put subtitles on your reel or captions, or do you have a supporting PDF or something similar, just to kind of break down almost the lineage of that minute or 2 minute show reel? Goes, this is what I worked on, rather than it just being, I'm trying to blind you with shiny things, you know, and amazingly polished work. So I think that's really, really good advice. Julia, anything to add on the reel discussion? I mean, lots of really interesting stuff from Kathleen and Margot there, but anything you'd like to add?
I think they had great points. I would say, you know, I would add to that, just stay relevant. Make sure your reels are updated. I would say, I can't tell you how many times it's happened where we've interviewed, you know, let's say an HOD or a supervisor, or someone in a leadership position, and we still want to know, or we still want to see what their eye is on things and how they're going to sort of bring that forth to the team they're leading. And so, you know, just ensure that you have relevant reels and up-to-date reels, or you know, and for those artists, I mean, we call them artists for a reason, because really everyone stands out. Everybody's very different and very unique. So how are you showcasing that in your reel, and how are you showing or making your mark in that reel, and just being accountable and being able to explain what exactly you did in the work that you're presenting? So that really helps us when we're interviewing.
Yeah. I'm learning a lot from these conversations as well, because I'm learning that a meaningful interaction, going back to one of our earlier conversations with a recruiter, is to go, hey, I've updated my reel. Is that something you would agree with, rather than a kind of go, hey, I'm still here, I haven't heard from you? It's more, actually, I've added this, I've added that, and it has a bit more meat to it, right?
Absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. I was going to just double check. I can see lots of nodding heads, but that's no good for an audio podcast, people.
I was going to say, they can't see our nodding heads on Spotify.
Lots of nodding heads, listeners, lots of nods. Okay, if I can stay with you on the next question, Julie, I want to talk about education. And this comes up a lot, particularly recently, or maybe the last 5 years or so, is how important is it for candidates to have some kind of specialized degree or some kind of certification in visual effects or animation versus a strong portfolio based on a kind of self-taught kind of approach? Because as we know, there's a lot of free software out there. There's a ton of YouTube tutorials and Vimeo tutorials. You know, what's your view? Is it a case of self-taught versus university educated? Is it a blend? I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
I don't think it's a one size fits all. I really think that it depends. I mean, I'm not one to say that education is really the only gateway in, and I'm not one to say that if you don't have it, it's the only gateway in. I think it could be a mix of both. I really feel like the important thing is, if you don't have the education, how are you self-teaching yourself? What are you doing to upskill yourself? And so I think we're more interested in that. Is it relevant to the trends that we're seeing out there? Is it relevant to the type of work or scope of work that we're looking for you to help us with? And so, you know, we're not going to disqualify someone if they don't have the education. Sometimes experience speaks for themselves. But at the same time, it's all about, what are you doing to upskill yourself? And, you know, if we see someone has sort of been, you know, stagnant for 10 years, let's say, you know, we'd want to know, what have you done in the last 10 years to stay relevant? And so it's kind of a mix of both in my eyes.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. Thank you, Julia. Kathleen, same question, really. What advice would you have for individuals out there who maybe may not have that formal education and maybe haven't had the benefit or even the opportunity to go to university? Because not everybody can afford that privilege, right? You know, but they have that genuine passion for the industry. You know, what advice would you give those folks?
Yeah, I mean, I am definitely an advocate for not spending all of your money on education if you can't afford it, because I know here in the United States, universities are just very expensive and it is just not in the realm of everybody's ability. But I think the thing you have to think about is what kind of learner you are, because if you're not able to kind of be that proactive, our favorite word of the day, kind of learning type, you know, to sit in front of a computer, watch a demo and, you know, do that work on your own independently, that's where the benefit of going to school really can help you. I don't think you necessarily have to go for a four-year degree. There are lots of like online courses or maybe opportunities to get more one-on-one mentorship with individuals that might help you work through that process, or like classes that you can watch that might be, again, online or even in community colleges that offer some kind of initial training. But I do think it will take a lot more self-drive and initiative to get yourself to be at the level of producing the kind of work that are going to be at the expectations of companies like Framestore. If you don't have the opportunity to go to a university and go through like a degree qualifying program. But that being said, in the last, you know, 10 years, even the amount of online resources has exploded. So there are so many more things accessible to individuals. There's more programs that are free or if not, you know, affordable for those that are learning. So there really is a way to go about it where you don't need to go through that formal education process. But I know like myself in the way that I learn, I would definitely need to be in a classroom. I am not the type to sit and watch a YouTube tutorial and gain a new skill that way. I need a little bit more of that interaction from, you know, a person that's showing me how they did something and then I can follow their direction. So I think that's just something to not discredit when you're thinking about, you know, should I go to, you know, a college or a university versus doing stuff online. But I think there's way more resources available. So it's definitely worth exploring and seeing which programs fit with what you're trying to do. I think there's free resources, if not as well, you know, Access VFX, shameless plug, Simon, for everything that you all do. And, you know, those types of groups that can help connect you, not even to, you know, training and mentorship internally through that organization, but also just other resources that they've found online that they can share with you to explore independently.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Kathleen. Margot, anything to add on that? Obviously, you're recruiting, you're at the coalface of your craft. Do you come across a lot of self-taught artists as well as kind of college, university educated? Do you have a view?
Yes, I feel like there's a bit of both. I mean, the tricky thing with, you know, joining the industry without like a, you know, university or a degree is to have access to the softwares. That's like, they're super expensive and, you know, it's tricky to have access if you're like outside. So I feel like the ones that Kathleen was talking about, like the, you know, the short training, such as, you know, a couple of months, couple of weeks, that could be a thing. So you could just have access, because it's good to, of course, watch YouTube videos, but if you don't have access to the software to just try and, you know, find your way into it, that's really difficult for sure. Yeah. So it's a good, you know, balance. I feel like if you don't want to do like a 3-4 years, which is okay. I know, for example, there's like, you know, classes such as Los Boys in Montreal, for example, like they do in 2 years, you can learn, you know, about compositing, which is really, usually it's like not even a thing sometimes for 3-4 year school. So they're trying to do more and more, you know, that kind of initiative, which I think is really good, because, you know, it's cheaper for sure for people to, it's more accessible to people, which is good, because they still need to have access to the softwares.
Of course. Of course. Thank you, Margot. And actually, on that point around accessibility, and Kathleen, thank you for the shameless Access VFX plug. And, you know, we talked about kind of, you know, almost social mobility in many ways, you know, people who don't always have access to those more privileged routes into education. You know, equity, inclusion and diversity is very close to Framestore's heart, and obviously huge, you know, a huge value to industry as well. I'd love to get a take on how Framestore approaches inclusion and diversity through our recruitment efforts. And perhaps, do you have any advice for candidates from underrepresented backgrounds looking to break into our industry? Julia, perhaps you could kick us off with this question.
Sure. Diversity inclusion is really ever evolving at Framestore. We have a social equity board, which is sponsored by our very own William Sargent and Mel Sullivan. And it's really focused on holding Framestore accountable to improve inclusion across attraction, retention. We have about 20 members globally and really at all levels. So the main focus, and it's ever evolving, we have it as part of our strategy every year is, collect data. Data from work experience, let's say, that includes gender, disability status, sexual orientation, religion, socioeconomic backgrounds. We are also leveraging what we call the work experience program, and that's really targeted to underrepresented groups. Yep. So this program, they launch it, four times per year in London. We're aiming to do that twice this year in Canada. We're really targeting high school students mm-hmm. who in under sort of represented and underprivileged areas of the city or of the country, whereby they may not have access to certain educations or industries. And from that perspective, we're working to develop these programs across the studios so that they can come in studio, work with us for at least a week. It's sort of an unpaid internship, and they can get exposure and learn from that standpoint. In terms of our attraction, our recruitment efforts, we are, constantly looking at ways to ensure there's no bias in our process as well. And so we do have some internal trainings there as well. We do have, the Diversity and Inclusion Board, we have internal comms, newsletters to keep everyone informed on what's going on. So yeah, I think there's numerous efforts going on from that perspective.
Thanks, Julia. Thank you. And Kathleen, from a US perspective, how does kind of the DE&I piece manifest itself through your recruitment efforts? Do you do it through kind of outreach? Do you get into kind of, schools and colleges and try and plant that seed early? Or is it kind of at the back of your mind when you're recruiting about, representation, if you're recruiting for a certain role that is particularly male and particularly white, or do you actively try to diversify that team? I mean, again, very crudely put question, but
yeah,
it's out there in the world now, so I can't do anything about it.
It's a little bit of both, Simon, as I'm sure we all can relate to, of trying to do the work to engage with these groups that are underrepresented at an earlier age to help kind of shift the makeup of the applicant pool that we get in the future. That's obviously kind of the long game and mm-hmm. something that's going to take a few years to really make the applicant pool different and more diverse for us. I think when it comes to the actual recruitment process, you have to try to put blinders on, I suppose, in a lot of ways when you're reviewing the applications and the ability to be as unbiased as you possibly can. And I think at the end of the day, our evaluation really comes to the portfolio and the work that they're representing, and then also things like the cover letter that will help kind of explain a person's process and their approach to problem solving and their creative thinking that kind of helps us eliminate some of the other elements that might, pivot our point of view in terms of how they would be relevant to this position, be it that the university they went to or, the location that they're from.
Yeah.
So, those are the types of things that I think kind of help us be able to diversify the workforce. It's still not perfect. I think we're still making a lot of efforts to try to get more people from different backgrounds to get excited about opportunities within visual effects and, want to pursue work with us at Framestore. I think Framestore has a very high bar of entry, which I think is a reality we all have to accept about the company we work mm-hmm. for. The standards are to be the best. And, sometimes it is about that portfolio that can showcase that. But even when you've got somebody that might be using things like Blender that aren't, industry standards, it's being able to see their dedication and their, again, kind of problem solving skills to the work that, might make it so that we would give them an opportunity and try to help bring them into the workforce. So that's something that I try to do when evaluating applicants that come through. As much as possible. Yeah. I think there's still a road ahead of us to continue to make improvements. And I'm grateful to be a part of a company that really wants to push that needle and is offering us the ability to do that with the kind of programs that Julia was mentioning. We haven't introduced those in the United States just yet, but I'm optimistic that we'll be able to soon. And then partnering with, you know, organizations like Access VFX and WIA, and we work with like Free Arts in New York, in particular BRIC in Los Angeles, trying to, again, just get ourselves connected to the other organizations that are trying to help these groups and see how we can partner and collaborate with them.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Kathleen. And how about you, Margot? Anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think just one of the advice I had in mind is that I think there was a study about the fact that usually candidates from like underrepresented backgrounds are, when they apply to a role, won't apply if they feel like they don't fit like at 70 or 80% of the job description, whereas usually overrepresented type of people will apply if they're only 20% fit, which is crazy when you think about that. So just as an advice, you know, to those candidates, please apply, please try. Like, don't be, you know, too harsh on yourself. I feel like, you know, they are harsh on themselves, which is like, don't, like, please apply. If you're not feeling, we're going to let you know why. But you should try and just, you know, be proactive for sure, because I feel like just being, you know, from like an underrepresented background means that you won't apply as much as someone who's not. So it's important to be like, yes, please do. Please apply. Please try. And we'll let you know if ever, you know, why is not working. But please apply just so we can actually see you. That makes sense.
Yeah. If you write a really good cover letter, you'll be sorted.
I'll hire you.
Yeah. You'll be taken on in a heartbeat, at least by Kathleen. Brilliant. Great advice. Thank you. So we're coming towards the end of the podcast now. I can't believe it's nearly over. We've been talking for over an hour, and I'm already thinking about my kind of exit strategy to kind of bring the podcast to a close. And I'm like, already? I feel like we're only just getting started, and there's so many questions I want to ask you. So I think it makes sense to lean into our finish and perhaps get a killer piece of advice from all three of you before we wrap up this episode. Like, one piece of advice that you would offer. It could be a do or a don't. You could throw in a couple if you want. It depends how greedy you want to be. But it's the big finish, right? So I want you to think of one or two really key pieces of advice you want to leave our listeners, particularly as we're trying to have an external focus with this conversation for people trying to get into the company. So who do I start with? I'm going to start with Margot. I think Margot's got a killer piece of advice up her sleeves. So Margot, what are you going to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, I think it's first with like what's happening right now, it's really about timing. So you just have to remind that about yourself. I feel like, you know, people are just a lot of, you know, they're like, I'm not sure about myself, you know, because of what's happening, and it's really the industry kind of state. Yeah. So first, don't be too harsh on yourself again. And I feel like one important thing, and I said it this morning already, so sorry, Julia, it's going to be another one, but it's really important to never forget that it's a win-win situation. Like when you're meeting a company, a studio, like it's never about just you getting in, you know, it's also being sure that the company will, you know, be able to challenge you, or, you know, you'll be able to learn. Like, it's a real win-win. So don't forget to not be like, please, you know, take me in, but also be like, prove to me that I should join you as well. You know, it's a real duo here, so you need to make sure that, you know, the company will be able to be there for you as well. It's really important, not just you proving things here in the process. So yeah, that would be my advice.
I love that. A win-win. Brilliant. Great advice. Super positive. Thank you, Margot. Julia, what's your golden nugget that you're going to bestow on our listeners?
It's actually kind of similar to Margot's. I would say joining Framestore is like the dating game, you know, and I always say this, my husband and I met at a good time, but I think had we met just a few years earlier, it may not have worked out, right? And it's really a timing thing at Framestore. You know, really, you know, we could have a project that is going on and it's the right time for you. And we may have met you a few months back or a few years back. And we keep you in our talent pool. So just trust the process that we have you, but stay relevant. And this is the best industry ever to just be your authentic self. So continue to focus on ways of how will you stand out and how will you do that. So yeah, so just trust the process. Be yourself.
The process.
And it's a dating game, really.
Yeah, right. I like that. Yeah, I'm sure your husband would have found a way to you, Julia, if you hadn't have met when you met. Come on, fate.
Perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. But I love what you said there. And I do think there's something in there about the visual effects community there. Like you may not hear from a recruiter. That's fair, right? You get so many emails, so many kind of things come through through the applicant tracking system. But kind of keep the faith or take the feedback and improve, or as we said earlier, those kind of meaningful interactions rather than just kind of firing out meaningless LinkedIn kind of in chats, are they called? I don't know what they're called now. LinkedIn messages, whatever. Being part of that community, I think, is really important. So thank you, Julia. It's akin to dating. Brilliant. Great advice. Kathleen, you get the enviable task of going last to do the big finish. So it better be good. What do you got for pressure? Yeah, right.
I guess, especially given the climate now, I'll just say, don't give up. If this is really what you love and what you want to do, I think you have to stay dedicated to it and continue to push yourself to improve constantly, and don't be discouraged by the rejections or the, we'll call you in a few weeks kind of mentality that might be going around at the moment. I think it's a very challenging, competitive industry to be a part of, but it's also incredibly rewarding. And there are a lot of opportunities to kind of look in different avenues that might still relate to your different skill set. But if this is really what you love, I think you stay focused on doing that and improving yourself constantly. And also remember that work isn't the only meaningful thing in life. So if you are in between jobs at the moment, to try to use that time to do something that's meaningful to you, because when you do get your job again and you are busy, you won't have that time to do it. So remember to kind of find that balance in your worth and not make everything about what your job is or, what you're working on. It's doing a bit of what's good for you and your mental health as well. Nice. Simultaneously. But yeah, just keep going and don't let the rejections be the end of things. If this is what you want to do, you'll find a way.
I love that. Perfect. Perfect end to the perfect podcast episode. Thank you all so much. My next question, just to finish, and it's not really a question, I almost don't want to ask it because I like these episodes to be evergreen, but this is a recruitment episode and it'd be remiss of me not to ask you, what are you hiring for at the moment if you are hiring? This episode goes out next Thursday. If somebody's listened to this podcast in the year 2026, this will be completely irrelevant. So you can stop listening now, dear listener. But for those listening on the release day or the release week, Margot, what are you recruiting for at the moment? Is there anything you want to put out there in the world?
Yeah, definitely animation and CFX. You can go ahead. We are looking for a lot of people.
Yeah. And get in touch with Margot on LinkedIn. I will share her LinkedIn credentials in the show notes so you can contact her directly. But make sure it's meaningful. Get in touch meaningfully. Julia, anything else you want to shout out?
For the time being, we're really just looking for animators and CFX artists. Sometimes, from time to time, we have some support roles. I don't foresee any before Thursday when this podcast is launched, but really, animators, CFX artists.
Animators, CFX. Great. Thank you, Julia. And Kathleen, over stateside, what do you want to put out there in the world, if anything?
Unfortunately, I won't have any open roles by the time this airs. We are just wrapping up accepting applications for our internship program across the US. But yeah, other than that, I don't have anything.
But do connect.
You can always connect because there's always things that kind of open up, in the future, and making that connection again, we'll be busier before we know it. And it's always good to kind of know who's out there. And I'm always willing to have a chat. So no reason not to connect.
Brilliant. And if you get some killer cover letters, you need to ask an interview. Did you by chance listen to the Framestore podcast episode 42?
Only for the US jobs, really. Because that's all you have to worry about.
Amazing. Well, thank you all so much. Thank you, Julia. Thank you, Margot. Thank you, Kathleen. Thanks for being on the Framestore podcast. I think people are really going to value the advice you shared on this podcast. And a shout out to your peers on episode 1 on the other side of the world as well. I think it's a really lovely compendium of advice in short bite-sized chunks. So thank you. Have a great day, and thanks again for being on the pod. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Simon.
Pleasure's all mine. And that concludes this week's episode. A huge thank you to Margot, Julia and Kathleen for another jam-packed career advice episode and insight into the inner workings of our Framestore talent teams. As always, a big shout out to Sam Sosnowski from the Global Training Team for the excellent editing job once again. In just 2 weeks' time, we return with another inspiring conversation from our global Framestore community. Until then, take care and thank you for listening. We'll see you then.